become your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, September 11, 2025, as we record this new show. There's a lot going on in the world right now. We know it could be overwhelming, so hopefully this episode is a bit of a reprieve. The White Sox baseball has been a reprieve. They have won another series, this time winning 2 out of 3 against Tampa Bay. The White Sox are now 8-2 in September, 9-2 when you extend that into August 31st. The White Sox are now 25-25 in the post-All-Star break part of the season. Here's White Sox manager Will Venable after Thursday's game, what this stretch of baseball means to him.
Well, it's great. Obviously, that's a big step forward for us, especially where the record was at in the first half, and just a testament to these guys and the work that they've done and continuing to go out there and fight every day. At the same time, we've been just focused on the things that, we believe in are going to help us win games. And, these guys, I think the reason why they're able to have good results is they've been really focused on those things. These guys are just focused on the things that they've really, committed to the whole year. As we get guys that are healthy and playing well and producing offensively and our pitching staff doing a great job, it's nice to get a little momentum and have some good results here.
Even though crowds are still sparse at Wrigley Field, you could feel that White Sox fans are getting more excited, and Venable shares that sentiment.
Yeah, certainly we feel it. You feel it when you're out there. You see them in person. People are excited. I think really our fans have done a great job supporting us from day one this year. Knowing our situation coming in, they've given us energy. They've been there in some exciting moments. And as we continue to win, they continue to show more support. It's great.
In this episode, we'll recap what happened against Tampa Bay. Kyle Teal, man, he's on a 20-game on-base streak. Shane Smith continues to deal, and we get the latest injury news on Grant Taylor. Plus, the Baltimore Orioles are interested in Josh Barfield. The White Sox are reported to have terms with a 12-year-old in the Dominican Republic, and a preview of this weekend series at Cleveland, the last series against an American League Central team in 2025. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, gentlemen, the White Sox. Stay hot. 8-2 now in September. They win another series against Tampa Bay. They win the season series. They are 25-25 since the All-Star break. This has been a lot of fun to watch. James, what's the mood in the clubhouse for the White Sox? Are the players themselves starting to buy that this level of performance is now the new norm on the South side?
I mean, yeah, I think they're generally upbeat about where things are going. And like I talked to Tavis Martin about it for a bit today, they viewed themselves as on an upward trend over the course of the season. Like they feel like it's one long kind of arrow up from the start of the season. So I think especially maybe more of the veterans are hesitant to say we might not lose 100 games, or they're more reminding there's a lot of stuff to work on. But I think someone like Sean Burke or even just Cole Montgomery, given the trajectory of his own season, feels it seems like we're playing a lot better. And generally I think the idea of just contending in every series and having a chance to win every series and feeling like they are, can go toe to toe with pretty much any team that comes in, even if they're not necessarily successful, is probably more where they're capping out their expectations than saying we're trying to win one. They wouldn't say we want to be 500, because that's not a rallying cry next year. And I don't think they're at the level of saying the division's ours next season anymore. I think it's more we want to be in the mix. We want to compete for it. Well, let's see what happens. We think we can play pretty well. We're playing well. We can match up with anyone, sort of level of excitement, but not expectations of any real puff your chest out stripe. I would be surprised if someone said Tigers are going to, they better be ready for us next year, sort of thing. I don't think it's quite that level of bravado. I think it's more introspective at this point.
Yeah, past September into end of August, the White Sox are 9-2 in their last 11 games. They are 2 feet away from Lenin Sosa's deep drive to right field, landing in fair territory to split that series against the New York Yankees, but ultimately they ended up losing that third game. Just a matter of inches, Jim. But as you always do every year, it's one of my favorite columns during the season, Jim, the halfway post, and where you just double up the numbers and see where the White Sox are on pace for.
And advanced for this season, analytics.
Yes, advanced analytics. And after this season, the White Sox at the halfway point were 26-55. So they are on their way on a pace to finish 52-110. However, in the true second half of this season, so even before the All-Star break, the White Sox are 31-35. That's a 76 win pace. Jim Margulis, if the White Sox finished 10-5 in their last 15 games, they could finish with a winning record in the second half. And now I have something to root for in these final 15 games, Jim, because I want maximum chaos in the Sox Machine comment section. Because if they can finish 10-5, okay, they go 18-7 in the month of September, we are going to see some of the craziest offseason plan projects ever on Sox Machine.
Especially since nobody knows exactly what Justin Ishbia's capital infusion is going to be. Like, probably paying down debt and just, you know, the behind the scenes stuff. And
hey, if you get yourself into debt and you pay that, you are paying down debt.
Exactly. Just, but he said like ongoing operations, which I imagine means like nothing new, nothing crazy, no $100 million contracts, but still that is looming out there. But yeah, it's funny looking at that, the post at the halfway point, and like Kyle Teal only had like 50 plate appearances, and you know, Colson Montgomery was just a glint in like Chris Getz's eye, maybe. I think that was just when he was like starting to come back from Arizona and like start to find some footing and just trying to figure out like how long it was going to last or whether it be up and down, like as turbulent as it was before. So yeah, those two guys providing some real pop and impact from the left-hand side, and everybody else upping their game. It's definitely a different team. It's not just one team having a bad first half and having an okay second half, and like kind of Andrew Vaughn-ish way you end up at a mediocre number that you don't feel great about. It is different enough to where you have just a different feeling team. So that's cool. When it comes to the offseason plan project, I have no idea in terms of what payroll to set, what, and that's good in a way. Like we talked about last time around, like the expectation should be higher given the way Chris Getz is not a set timeline, given the way that you always heard, Rick Hahn talk about like not too distant future, try to obscure timelines or aspirations, except for the multiple parades part where he let the mask slip and never finished hearing about it when it came to the, his last days as a GM. It'll be nice for people to say like, yeah, there's a core to build around here. Or if there's not like a core in the sense of like the White Sox core of like Jose Abreu and Chris Sale and Adam Eaton, Jose Quintana, et cetera, there's like evidence that the White Sox can build a lineup out of good pieces and then keep changing players in and out and find some success there, like find some complementary pieces that actually fit together. So whether it's people going all out and saying, yeah, we're going to double the payroll this year, or just people having more confidence in what the White Sox can do. And like, maybe if you do like, they have to move some parts around, whether it's Edgar Caro or Lenin Sosa or something like that. Like there are some interesting trades to discuss too, that could provide those complementary pieces. So yeah, it's going to be fun and dare I say, if not optimistic, at least ambitious, to where it should be actually not a chore this time around to read them and to put them together.
Since the All-Star break, position-wise, when you go on Fangraphs.com and you look at position war by teams, right now the White Sox are getting top five performances from the catchers, shortstop, and second base, which, again, a big pleasant surprise and a big driver to the White Sox having a lot more success post-All-Star break and, as we just mentioned, in the second half. And I think a lot of that goes to Kyle Teal. We talked about a couple podcasts ago with Colson Montgomery's home runs. Is he overshadowing with just how well Kyle Teal has been playing for the White Sox. James, Teal now has a 20-game on base streak, and you wrote a fantastic feature on SoxMachine.com earlier this week about how both Teal and Edgar Caro are improving defensively. If you didn't get a chance to read that, listeners, definitely go back and check that article out, because the comments from Drew Butera and even pitching coach Ethan Katz and just how both of them have progressed is really good insight on what the White Sox are trying to do to help these guys out in their rookie years be better defensively. But offensively, very impressive. Teal had a pinched hit, two-run RBI single for the White Sox today against Tampa Bay. James, what is Teal's ceiling? Do we have a good grasp of this? Because right now, post All-Star break, Fangraphs is considering Teal a top five catcher in MLB. I feel like that's ambitious, but the way that he's been hitting, it's hard to argue.
I mean, you mean just Fangraphs WAR is considering?
Yeah, WAR, WRC plus, he's in the top five. He's leading catchers in average and on base percentage since the All-Star break.
I thought you meant like Eric had secretly written about Teal, like re-ranked him.
Re-ranked him. He's now a future value 60 grade. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I don't think we have a good grasp. I think at the trade and certainly being like both talking to scouts like when the trade happened and like subsequently, though, even then, I don't think anyone really moved off their evaluation. But like spring in any way was like some people thought like he could be good, and obviously like a good catcher is very valuable. But some people saw him as maybe just like a steady two WAR guy, like a lot of just like good, solid average tools across the board. I think there's like athleticism there, and he's a better runner than in general. And obviously he's able to use his levers for full power. And, you know, we've seen all the things that like could be good about him, but like no one thought there was like a big 60 grade tool, necessarily with him, other than maybe like raw power. So I think like obviously if he continues performing and you know if his framing ticks up the way it has like in the second half, I think it's probably gonna be pretty hard to deny him a little bit. Like, and on one hand, like he shaved his strikeout rate, I think, like obviously the power he's had has stood out in the second half, but he's like shaved his strikeout rate from like 27% to like right around 20, like where he was really trending as he got mature as a prospect, especially in the Red Sox system, of people saying like, all right, this is somebody who can maybe hit 20 bombs, but maybe he's going to be 230, which is not like a huge diss with modern batting average, but like a below average batting average type of, you know, power over hit approach to do it. So that now that he's like flirting with a, you know, 390 OBP and all this stuff, like, yeah, we thought walks are going to be part of his profile and he's going to be able to get on base even with a lower batting average. I would say he's outperforming his contact rate, his raw contact rate with what he's doing strikeout wise. But if he's doing stuff to keep himself alive with the two strikes, or just not chasing with two strikes relative to the mean, like maybe he's found some like ways around it. And certainly it seems like there's some ability. You know, I think his early count swings look like pretty significant power hacks, and maybe there's a bit more ability that we're seeing with, you know, is able to shave it down when he does need some contact. But like the output stats right now don't really have a big flaw in them. You'd think he'd come back to earth a little bit based on like maybe what's under the hood. But if he's even just like a steady 115 WRC plus guy and he matures into a good framer and, you know, all the other softer skills kind of come along with it, like that easily becomes very valuable and not just like, you know, a garden variety starting catcher. So I think we're kind of finding out what the ceiling is as things go on. And, you know, at this point, all he can really lift it beyond like good starting catcher is just to pile up the track record. But he's obviously doing that right away when usually it's supposed to take time, especially for a catcher.
And Jim, because in the American League, catcher suddenly became like a loaded position. You know, Cal Raleigh's having a historical year. Shea Langeliers over in Sacramento for the Athletics, man, what a second half he's having. You never know when Salvador Perez is going to decide, I'm going to hit 40 home runs this type of season. I would say going into next year, those are probably your favorites to make the All-Star team. But Jim, if this is real, if Kyle Teal's a 310 batting average guy with a 400 on base percentage, like Kyle Teal could be a future All-Star for the White Sox.
Yeah, I'm having a really hard time thinking of a comp for Teal, like as a catcher. Just because they fall either between like being like not exciting and then maybe too exuberant. I think it's partially because he's not a great defender yet. So like if you say like the White Sox have an Adley Rutschman, well, he has platoon concerns, Teal does, and the defense isn't there, like Rutschman's Gold Glove. Teal's not quite there yet, but in terms of like Teal being the long side of a platoon at a position that does get regular rest, like that impact is not out of the question, as he matures as a defender to where the White Sox have acquired that kind of fixture. But like the athleticism, the average, which you don't see from catchers much, I think there's concern about whether it be average over power or power over average, and right now it's kind of a pleasant mix of both to where he's hitting mistakes, and if he's not crushing the mistakes, he's working the at bat longer. So like what catcher fits that mold? And it's like Joe Mauer, you don't want to compare him to Joe Mauer. Like Buster Posey, don't want to compare him to Buster Posey just yet, but it is a case where it is, if that skill set sticks, it's a very enjoyable catcher to watch and really a big bonus, as you saw from the way those teams enjoy that kind of production. So I'm watching, I'm trying to learn more about him and trying to figure out exactly what he is, but just it's kind of fun when no comps come to mind, in a healthy way. No, it's like there's nobody in the history of baseball like Kyle Teal. Like, no, not quite. It's just more, the strengths and flaws don't exactly match up with guys we know, and I'm still trying to figure that out.
It's been fun. It's been fun to watch him progress. I know that White Sox fans, when he got drafted one pick before the White Sox a few years ago, were just hoping he could slip through from Boston. But him, I mean, this trade with Garrett Crochet, I mean, Garrett Crochet has a real chance of winning the Cy Young for the Boston Red Sox. But for what the White Sox have received from Boston, the production from Chase Mydroth, who made a sensational catch on Thursday, and he also had a perfect day at the plate. Chase Mydroth starting to hit a little bit again. He's been hot as of late. And you get Kyle Teal. I'm excited about Brady Montgomery. Winkelmann Gonzalez, Jim, looked good out of the bullpen. The White
He's
Sox,
confounding. Like
he
in
is confounding. He's
it
probably
just
just a
I
reliever
don't
now, right,
understand how he
James?
works.
Okay. He's strictly a reliever. Winkelmann moving forward.
I would imagine, yes.
Yeah, Winkelmann, yeah.
They obviously with the 40-man clock, like they were kind of in terms of like running out of options, they were compelled to kind of get something, but it's not like he wasn't showing command issues that already suggested he was bullpen bound. And it's not like he's even his good work out of the bullpen is not like evident of like, how about 6 innings of this? I bet it would be smooth sailing. So
Yeah.
I haven't seen the progression toward that. I think it's more like, let's just make the stuff as nasty as possible right at this point.
This trade's been great for the White Sox so far. And again, Boston is getting a great deal of value having Garrett Crochet
A
in their
Cy
starting
Young would
rotation.
really, a caliber ace would really tie the room together with this roster. I bet we'd be feeling very good about the second half with,
Yeah, but you would still need Kyle Teal. You'd still need a
Well, yeah,
Chase
Caro
Mydroth from
though.
somewhere.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
depends on what it, I think if they trade, like if they trade one of their two catchers and what they get from that, that'll kind of put the put it in more of a context. But yeah, when you trade for if you're the best player in return for Crochet is a player you didn't necessarily need, I think there are still more moves to untangle before you call it like a true win-win.
For both sides.
Yeah.
I can buy it. It's a lot better than the Dylan Cease trade.
Oh yeah.
I don't think it's much of a competition.
Yeah, it's their best of the lot at this point, I would say.
Yeah.
Apologies, Miguel Vargas.
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful with Kyle Teal and what the White Sox have had in return so far for Garrett Crochet to Boston. Again, it's working out great for Boston, but with Kyle Teal in this 20 game on base streak and with how well he's been playing, I am hopeful this is really going to pan out for the White Sox. Moving over to the pitching side, the big story from this series out of the Rays series is a little bit of an injury scare from the bleachers in section 108. I thought maybe Grant Taylor blew out his arm, But, and I guess the good news is that it is a groin strain. So, James, what did we learn about Grant Taylor? Did you get a chance to chat with Grant Taylor? How's he doing?
He's all told he's not going in the IL. They're basically going to give him the weekend. Even Taylor just said like a day or two, but I think the Sox said more like he'll be down a couple of days. I feel like him missing like Cleveland series is like a minimum. But between the expanded rosters and, you know, thinking maybe he could be back pretty like within 10 days, obviously, they're just going to kind of let it ride and see how he responds. They said he's already a little bit better Thursday. So it, because Taylor's kind of a reserved dude, so I think the level of like resignation on his face seemed like more ominous than it was when it was probably for him discussing. It was just more of a matter of fact affair of like he was kind of feeling something weird in the first at bat, as you see him kind of lose his control, and then like the first pitch he felt something very specific on the second at bat, and he was like, no reason to like do this, which, you know, obviously is what you want them to do in that situation. But it's hard to say that to a rookie who's trying to, you know, save a one run lead. So kudos on him. But yeah, it definitely looked spooky, given that, you know, Taylor throws hard. He's like, he's kind of up here a little bit because of a bit of injury concerns. He's obviously dealt with that other parts of his career. But at this point, it's nothing arm related. It doesn't seem like it's, you know, even going to end his season, as little left that there is.
Well, that's really good news. Okay. It didn't look great being at the stadium, but that's great news regarding Grant Taylor. Speaking of great news on the pitching side, Shane Smith, really strong start again against Tampa Bay. I noticed that he was throwing his two seamer a little bit more, especially with confidence in the lower part of the zone. He was still mostly four seamers, but he was able to steal some strikes in the lower part of the zone with that sinker. And Jim, I know I was worried about Smith gassing out, and we had a whole podcast episode about the pitching staff of the White Sox going to gas out as Smith is reaching a new career single season innings high throughout any level that he's ever pitched at. And in his last eight starts, he's only allowed 14 earned runs over 44 and a third innings. That's a 2.84 ERA and going 5.5 and two thirds scoreless innings against Tampa Bay. Jim, is it possible that Smith is getting stronger as we get closer to the finish line of this season?
Possible. Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, like it's a nice symmetrical finish to his season when he started out in spring training and really made his mark as somebody throwing 98. And he's not quite throwing that hard because he does have to meet it out over five innings plus versus the short stints early in spring when he's just trying to make the roster and show what he has. But in terms of the bully ball of just attacking hitters, fastball, not getting, I think he only threw eight changeups, which if you told me that, you know, Smith was back to form, I'd think like, oh, he's ironed out his changeup. He's throwing it 25% of the time. He's locating it better. And that's how he's getting by. And it turns out like, no, it's mostly hard stuff. It's mostly just imposing. And James wrote about the sinker coming in, the two seamer, just giving two movement profiles in his fastball. And all of a sudden, like that's enough. It's impressive. The guy I always think about, you know, when it comes to like fastball movement and just really simplifying things is like Bartolo Colon. And, you know, Lance Lynn was a version of that, of just being able to get by moving fastballs in the zone and not knowing if it's going to rise or sink or cut. And it seems like, you know, Smith is not quite at that level, and he's got the secondary that, you know, especially like Lynn didn't have. But just in terms of getting by and having this wrinkle to finish the season with, of having a second fastball, like we've seen that before. So, you know, as he goes into the offseason and whether he finds that, you know, curveball or slider that he can really locate with regularity, like that would be the finishing touch. But even then, if you're looking for somebody to fill out a rotation, I think once he showed what he had in terms of velocity and changeup, the big concern was, can he throw a full season like that? And the fact that he is like, okay, I guess that just means like for the agenda going into next season, it's just do it again. You know, maybe without the lull in the middle of the season. And that's pretty good.
Yeah. Tampa Bay hitters We're befuddled with that two-seamer at times, James. It's a lot of pitching ninja highlights for Shane Smith coming. A lot of swords from Tampa Bay hitters against Smith on that two-seamer. Is that the primary focus for him, at least finishing off this 2025 season, just trying to perfect that two-seamer as much as possible?
I mean, it's certainly taken like a big emphasis. I think they want him to be aggressive and attack in the zone, and they felt he was nibbling more or being kind of passive in the way he had approached at bats, and that the way they got him back towards being aggressive was emphasizing like just challenging your fastball and like sprinkle in stuff when you need to. Stop thinking about like getting your slider right or you know how much your changeup or thinking in terms of like using your secondaries and how much you want to use them, and more like respond to when the hitters tell you that you need to throw anything other than just like dominating them with fastballs. And it's certainly easier to do that when he's sitting, you know, or hitting 97 than, you know, sitting 94. I think it's more like a mentality he's trying to embrace, that, you know, attacking with his heater in the zone got with it. And, you know, should mention like got the biggest out of the game on Thursday with it, with a sinker that, you know, Junior Caminero hit for a double play, which obviously is something that he does a lot, but having that tool to basically expose the flaw of like the best hitter in the lineup in a big moment. So pretty big endorsement of the progress he's made with it.
Yeah, Smith could have four more starts before the 2025 season closes. If he can do that, he'll get the 30 games started this season, and he's got a chance to reach 150 innings. So to your point, Jim, that's like a full season workload for a rookie, and hopefully he can build on to that in 2026 and qualify for the ERA title and punch a hole near the nearest wooden object, podcast listeners, that nothing happens in the offseason or spring training. Not try to jinx the guy, but with all the injuries the White Sox had at spring training this year, hopefully endurance issues don't come up for Shane Smith. But it's been a fantastic season for Shane Smith. And yeah, if he makes each start, he'll start the last game of the season in Washington, D.C. for the White Sox with a chance to, if he hasn't already, reach 150 innings in 2025. And then we did get a chance to see Sean Burke in this series. Uneven results for Sean Burke. He went 4 1/3 innings against Tampa Bay. He allowed 5 hits, 3 earned runs, which came off 2 home runs against Sean Burke. 5 strikeouts, but 4 walks. He did hit 99.8 miles per hour, according to StatCast, with a 4-seam fastball in the first inning to get a strikeout to end the inning. James, what's the game plan for Sean Burke for the rest of the 2025 season?
I don't think that's known at this point. Okay. I feel like he's start to start. I certainly think it'd probably be an easier way for them to finish the season is just have him fill it out. Like we asked him if we thought he'd be up for a while. He said, I hope so. he was obviously still here, like kind of got optioned pretty immediately afterwards. Yeah, obviously he struggled more pronouncedly than Burke did, but there's really no purpose of, like, obviously they could switch things up for the road trip, but like there's no purpose of carrying a starting pitcher on the roster on a day where he's not starting unless you plan him to start again. And he was meeting with Ethan Katz on Thursday morning pregame before I interviewed him. So I think that's leaning towards at least getting one more start. He didn't have an especially long leash in that game. There's a reason, like, certainly if you just got sent down for being inefficient and you walk the bases loaded with no one out in the second inning, I don't think it's unreasonable for Will Venable to have gotten Wickham and Gonzalez up in that moment. But I think it just kind of represents like that they were ready for like, okay, we've seen this, let's get ready. And not, I don't know if they necessarily get Wickham and up if Martin Perez did that on Friday. But once again, like when he turned the lineup over to a third time, like once he got into trouble, they pulled him really quickly after that as well. They've mentioned like him being kind of a little bit close to counting his innings a little bit. So I don't think he necessarily has as much of a full leash as Shane Smith, since he's coming off even less innings last season than Smith did. So that could be a factor a little bit. But he certainly feels like he found something mechanically his last week in Charlotte that he talked about, and I'll probably write it up for a couple days or next week or whatever. But like, it's about kind of keeping his hips square through the way. And he said he was watching video of other pitchers that he kind of regularly checks in on because he thinks his delivery is similar and noticed what was different out of his. So there's something to cling on to. He did acknowledge, like, kind of Jim's point a little bit of he gets a little inefficient when he's too fastball, curveball with heavy with lefties. He threw like only three the other night, but to his point about how to use it, like, that's not him avoiding it. That's more like his changeup is really never going to be something he's going to use unless like it's absolute. It's something for him to sprinkle in once he sees that the fastball curveball combo is kind of spinning its wheels. It's never going to really appear before that. You're not going to see him throw like a first pitch changeup probably, unless it was some weird situation. So it at least sounds like someone who has a bit of a plan that is in response to what they got optioned for. And, you know, obviously at least the velo suggested that his mechanics are in better sync than they were. But I think it's probably a little start to start at this point.
Yeah, because at that point, Jim, obviously, I think the White Sox would love to try to continue to see if Sean Burke can be a starting pitcher because the White Sox need that type of depth. But the arm talent, in that first inning, it caught my attention looking at Baseball Savant. 99.8 miles per hour. Okay, I think, is there a backup plan here for the White Sox in which if it doesn't work out on the starter front for Sean Burke, could they pull a Grant Taylor and put him into the bullpen and see, can we get 101? Can we get 102? And does it make sense for you just to be a four-seam curveball guy in short stints?
I'd be surprised if 102 was there or something like that. I think like 99. I don't know if I've ever seen him throw that hard in any capacity or like any kind of reports of that when he was in his prospect days or coming out of Maryland. Like it was eye-opening, and then, you know, kind of settled down after that to where it did come back to earth a little bit. But now I could see a relief future for him just because, you know, if he does continue to throw like these four inning starts, like it's hard to be useful in that regard. I think the question would be, you know, is the fastball curveball sequence enough to lefties? Because that is the issue. Like, the lefties have been killing him this year. It's just, it's been tougher to watch than it's been on his line. Like, just a lot of long at bats, a lot of walks. Like, the walk rate is really high. He's been really careful against him, but when they stack lefties against him and he's facing as many lefties as righties and he has to be careful to so many hitters, you know, whether it's being intentionally careful or just the way this pitch mix looks that he's, you know, not trying to give in, you know, it gets kind of tedious watching him. So, you know, the answer to that would be like shorter stints, like just one inning. Can you rebound enough to throw your best stuff, you know, once every 3 days, occasionally a couple times in a row? Like, that's kind of unknown about him, and whether his like mechanics can be good enough out of the gate to where we need you in a high leverage situation. Can you throw strikes right away, or do you have to warm up to it, or do you have to find your release point, get everything in sync? That I think that's my reservation for thinking it's an easy switch for him to be a reliever. But given the limited repertoire and given like that, the biggest problem is maybe inefficiency more than just like getting crushed by hitters of the other handedness. There's a possibility. And, you know, as the rotation shakes out, as you see, you know, hopefully these Tommy John surgery victims come back, you know, and provide some starting depth, like that might be a way to open up a rotation spot and also solve a bullpen problem at the same time.
Well, that recaps the White Sox series against Tampa Bay. Again, they win the season series 4-2 against the Rays in 2025. Other news for the Chicago White Sox. The Baltimore Orioles have made some front office changes. They promoted their GM to be president, and now they have an opening for general manager. And according to Mark Feinsand of MLB.com, he tweeted out, according to a source, the Orioles indeed had interest in White Sox assistant general manager Josh Barfield for a potential front office role, but Barfield plans to stay in Chicago and will not be joining Baltimore. And then Bruce Levine of 670 The Score in Chicago tweeted, White Sox assistant GM Josh Barfield told the team that his goal is to see the job through and be a winner with Chicago. Report on refusing Orioles' interest as general manager candidate, first Mark Feinsand. James, I know you mentioned this in the group chat with the Sox Machine Veterans Committee, but if Josh Barfield left for from Chicago to Baltimore for this job, it would feel like a lateral move, right? Because even though it's a general manager position, there's still a president of baseball operations over you. So do you really have control of the team? Like, that would be the question.
I mean, I'm sure like there's some, you know, you're one of 30 GMs. It's a special like job, and it's it would be a bump in title and it'd be meaningful, like bump in visibility. But like, as far as like changing from, you wouldn't be the top baseball decision maker in the team. And so I think he's pretty prominent here. Like, he's effectively, you know, there's also Jin Wong as far as assistant general managers, but like, he's probably the second most prominent like baseball decision maker as far as like being front facing, in terms of like, he's spoken to the media multiple times, like giving, you know, updates, on the team and kind of speaking as a GM. He said Paul Yonish was something that he's been trying to like hire for several years before he got this opportunity to bring him on as farm director. So like, that's part of like this organizational infrastructure and like influence he has here, where it's like, I don't think it's a title bump necessarily makes him like more influential than he already is kind of here. Like, obviously it's like personal for him, and obviously the stated reasons that, you know, even been reported, it could go beyond that, but like, it's not necessarily this inherent like huge bump in like responsibility that, you know, would drag someone away who's obviously comfortable and, you know, happy with what they're doing.
Yeah. And also, the White Sox have a better run differential than the Orioles. Like, it's a case where if you feel like you're going into an organization that might be in flux, or, you know, they did promote Elias secretly to president of baseball operations. Like, they didn't mention that they did it. And like, this is a case where, should he be fired because of how the Orioles are collapsing this year and how much they've disappointed and how much the root problems are ones that everybody saw in the offseason, wondered why they didn't address them. And all of a sudden he's being promoted to president of baseball operations. You could look at that from the outside and be like, do I want to walk into that? Is it a case where they can course correct, or are they just committed to a very conservative model that wasn't good enough to get the job done? And then all of a sudden you're second in command to somebody who's very unpopular and the whole thing could be tossed out, versus being in a place with the White Sox where you're seeing some progress. You're seeing, you have a sense that Chris Getz probably has a considerable amount of job security right now. And you do have the ability to put your vision into action and see the results and have room to fail. Whereas if you go to Baltimore in the state it is right now, I'm not sure it's a good job. At least, you know, if it's a lateral move, it's a good move. Like, if you're going from like a second assistant GM or like, you know, special assistant, whatever you want to call it, to GM, like, sure, that's a good job. That's one of 30. At this point though, like, yeah, I mean, the White Sox, I wouldn't say they're necessarily better off than the Orioles, but you can make a case for, if you are responsible for the progress, or you feel like you're responsible for the progress they made in the second half, to jump away from that to a tougher division, to a place where they really don't seem to have the kind of spending power that you'd probably want to leave the White Sox for. I could see staying put being a you know, even though it is the White Sox, a pretty appealing decision.
Yeah, it's been reported that Carter Hawkins, one of the Chicago Cubs front office personnel, is in contention for that general manager spot. And Cubs Twitter had a field day with that. They're like, oh no, don't take Carter away from us.
What about the 2032 Cubs?
But it's nice to be wanted, Jim. Like, this is different. This is different from the Hahn and Williams era. Somebody is trying to poach a front office member.
I mean, Hahn was approached by the Mets and the Pirates, I believe, before they handed the reins over. So it is, you know, it harkens back to like the 2009, I think, probably era Williams Hahn front office. So, but yeah, when it comes to the Hahn Williams front office, or the William, whatever you want to call it, in terms of like who was front facing versus who was actually calling the shot, et cetera. Yeah, it's been a while.
The other big news for the White Sox, and this comes from Francis Romero down in the Dominican Republic. He tweeted out, the Chicago White Sox are expected to land young Dominican prospect Braxton Basker for a bonus sign record of $6 million starting in January 15, 2030. And then Francis reported that Basker was initially tied to the Yankees, but that pre-agreement fell through a few weeks ago. So Braxton Basker is 12 years old. He's not eligible to technically sign until the 2030 international class. But this is something that you've been hinting at, James, with the White Sox completely rebooting their international scouting efforts. This is what it's going to look like moving forward, right, for the White Sox. It's not so much what they're going to get in 2026 or maybe 2027, but it is going to be more of these long shots in 2029, clearly 2030, and maybe even beyond.
Please stipulate that I did not promise kids scouting, but sure. In general, I would think, well, anyway, what are you saying? 2027 is probably the first class that will be representative of the new staff.
Okay.
Based on talking to people. Even then, that won't really represent like them having a full footprint necessarily, because obviously the deals are being worked out so far in advance that even like when they are in place, like, you know, they're already necessarily shut out of some of deals like at this range that are already pretty much agreed to. I want to say, who did I know I interviewed Javier Mogollon last year at the complex, and the name is slipping my tongue of the guy I interviewed. But both were Venezuelan players who...
Christian Gonzalez.
Talked about like basically joining an academy in their country when they were 10. Obviously from that point, like the people who are running that academy are putting in touch with scouts from teams, you know, from that point. So while this is like very bad example of, you know, aggressive, unfettered capitalism. this is, I guess, the White Sox behaving on a level of like industry par for the course of like, this is the market that, you know, teams compete on for this, and they are dipping their toe in. Whether this will come to pass, obviously, because it's a report about a pre-agreed deal from, you know, God knows how long before falling through, and, you know, it's another, you know, over 4 years before this become official in any way, or he'd be in a complex. We'll see. But it is reflective. Like, I had heard good things. I'd heard them express confidence about what they had lined up for like 2028, like people in the organization. And I thought like, wow, that really shows how far in advance they were. Little did I know. So this goes to show you.
I can't wait.
Are the CBA, you know, that's what I wonder, like, will that blow up deals that far out if there is the international draft? So that's why it's like, it's weird to me to be like thinking about it that far.
I mean, on one respect, maybe, but like, obviously some of these White Sox deals that they brought in last class and this coming one will have survived the people making them getting fired. So if they can endure that, they can endure most anything. I don't, it remains to be seen. I remember, because you bring up the same point that a commenter did, and I realized that they were making the point you did, but like, my instinctual reaction was like, this CBA doesn't allow this. This is just how this works.
True.
So, they're kind of existing outside the universe of the CBA in terms of actual rules enforcement already. So I don't know. Like, it'll be swayed by something like that.
That's more like if they do somehow manage to do a draft, I think would be the, and right. Then even then that might have the same kind of, slot value thing that allows, deals to happen outside the natural order in the domestic draft, but still like, yeah, that's, I think that would be probably the biggest thing that might.
It would at least cause some turnover.
Yes.
If not utter chaos.
I can't wait. 11 years from now, Jim, when we are going crazy because Braxton Basker hit a walk-off home run for the White Sox. And we remember, wow, we haven't seen a rookie hit this well since Kyle Teal in our 23rd year podcasting about the White Sox. Oh,
Oh, this is awesome.
They've moved the Arizona Complex League to Montana. Basically water roll at this point.
Yeah. Hopefully we get there. But yeah, the White Sox hard at work trying to improve the international efforts. One question that I constantly get, James, and I don't know if there's an answer to this. I don't know if you've heard anything. Jeff Madison wrote a pretty detailed article about the free agent class this upcoming offseason of the winter meetings. A lot more players from Japan coming over to the United States to sign with major league clubs. Are the White Sox trying to navigate in those waters again as far as to have a better presence or bigger presence in Japan or even Korea?
Yes, but I wouldn't expect to see like fruit from it. I think they like, I could say it's David Keller went on a trip to like the Pacific Rim, like recently this season, kind of for the purpose of like establishing a footprint. But yeah, I don't think that means they're getting like the top guy from Japan necessarily off it. I think it's more like we need to establish here and start working here and start making contacts.
Got it. Okay. Cause that could be like another 5-year project. Like it could take a while to rebuild those relationships.
Or I don't think it's rebuild.
Oh, okay. Just establish them.
It's like the same people who worked out the Iguchi deal. I think it's more, it's probably more new. Well, just there's been so much White Sox staffing turnover between them too.
Yeah. Some guys have went to prison. Yeah. Well, that's the White Sox international efforts and then Baltimore trying to poach Josh Barfield, but getting denied. White Sox back in action this weekend. They head to Cleveland as Cleveland won a series against the Kansas City Royals. Big win on Thursday for them. Come from behind a late home run in order to beat the Royals there. They're 75-71. They're still alive in the American League wild card. They are 6-4 in their last 10. This season, they are 38-34 at home. Against the White Sox, Cleveland has crushed. They are 8-2 against the White Sox this season. The White Sox are only averaging 2.9 runs per game. Do the math. They've only scored 29 runs against Cleveland. The last time the White Sox played in Cleveland this season was all the way back at the beginning part of the year, April 8th or the 10th. The White Sox got swept in that series. They only scored 3 runs total in those 3 games. We'll circle back to that in a moment. Your pitching problems for this series, Friday night, September 12th, 6:10 p.m. Central Time. Martin Perez will take the ball for the White Sox, hoping to bounce back from his last start. It'll be Tanner Bibee for the Guardians. Saturday night, 5:10 p.m. Central Time. The Dart, Davis Martin takes the ball against lefty Parker Mesick for Cleveland. And then on Sunday at 12:40 p.m. Central Time, I know it's the Bears and Lions game, but your second TV, your smartphone, your tablet, whatever you got, tune in for the White Sox. Yoenis Gomez will take the ball against Slade Ciccone, which Ciccone had a really good start for the Guardians recently. He had a no-hitter going for a while. But, Jim, I want to return back to, and it kind of comes full circle with this podcast episode. The last time the White Sox played the Guardians in Cleveland was in early April. And that was a bore of a podcast for us to do because here we are trying to talk about a team that scored a whopping 3 runs in 3 games. But this has been a much better offensive output for the White Sox since the All-Star break. They're averaging well more than 5 runs per game. They're doing it in multiple ways. They can go big on you with big home runs, or they can play small ball like they did against Tampa Bay, and you're surprised that they even put together 5 runs, but that's what the scoreboard says. Do you think that the hot bats for the White Sox will change their previous outcome against the Guardians in Cleveland this weekend?
Boring answer is they can. But we've talked about it before in terms of, you know, going from the Twins and beating up on them to facing better opponents and just seeing what this more balanced lineup can do, especially like when Mike Tauchman is healthy. Like that's a case where, you know, they've done a pretty good job of nursing him through legs that don't seem to work. Like it's weird. Like they just sputter and kind of come to life and almost collide into Brooks Baldwin center field. And then he can't really round second base at various points. Like I don't quite get it. But, you know, he's managing to lengthen a lineup and be at the top of the order and do damage. And so having that kind of balance and having the, you know, the Guardians are who come to mind when thinking about like a lineup that can roll out a lot of lefties, even if they don't have a lot of name brand value. It's just getting tougher at bats against right-handed pitching. And so that's what I'm really intrigued by seeing. I'm less intrigued by like seeing CJ Kafis turn into like the new Josh Naylor. Like that's, he's doing nothing this September. And I imagine like he'll somehow just overwhelm the White Sox again. And, you know, Stephen Kwan's been kind of quiet and like he can come back. So, you know, they have the same thing of just having lefties who can do damage, you know, ordinary lefties, lefties who don't scare you on paper, just punish them again and again. Like Kyle Manzardo is actually like doing pretty well the second half. Yeah. Finally giving the Guardians like the left-handed bat that they've been, you know, seeking for I don't know how many years. Like he seems like he's finally doing it. So I think it's a good matchup in terms of if you want this White Sox offense to contend earlier than you think, or even earlier than the front office can think, having lefties who can just get a lot of three-run games or four-run games when you think they might be held to one, and that might be good enough to win on a given day. Like that's what you're looking at. And so if nothing else, you know, you're looking at how the White Sox can possibly model an offense for next year against this team.
And the White Sox had a great series against Detroit. It took Tarik Skubal, as we had that podcast episode, to shut them out. And the White Sox put up a lot of runs in those other two games against the Tigers. Hopefully they do repeat that. Back to Mike Tauchman. James, I chuckle at your text. When Tauchman was hitting a double, it feels like he immediately regrets his decision when he hits a ball in the gap.
It's kind of like his posture when he's running, because it's very like head down, and like then because his shoulders are like kind of harped up, because and he's not like digging into his legs as much as he can. He just, and like his general like very all business expression, it just doesn't look like someone who's, it's not, it doesn't look like Miguel Vargas like doing a hustle double, like to put it like that. Yeah. Obviously he's dealing like a lot of like discomfort, and I've talked about it, like he's very frustrated, like that's not how he's used to playing, like he wishes he could like dig more, like you see him kind of have these moments where he like lets it eat a little bit because like it's clearly killing him, so like the heart goes out to him, but yeah, it's not how you typically see big leaguers like have to operate. And I mean, given how many times we've seen like other White Sox players who looked a little hobbled and it kind of craters into disaster pretty quickly, I'm impressed that like they've been able to kind of manage it for multiple months on end at this point.
Yeah, this is his first season without a stolen base attempt, and I imagine that's not going to change.
No, but he plays so hard defensively though, Jim. Like he goes after them, especially at the wall. That's the thing that shocks me in both a good and a concerning way of, please don't hurt yourself while trying to rob this home run. But he has that ability.
Well, it seems like he's trying to, like, the way he contemplates the cost benefit or the risk reward is like, I'd rather prevent a base than try to take one offensively. Okay. Like if I can cut off a ball at the gap, or if I can run down a ball at the line, that's worth it more than going from first to second when I don't have to, or scoring from second to home just because there's run prevention involved. There's a pitcher on the other side of it. And you know, there's somebody to actually serve.
I appreciate that for a team that definitely does need to play better defense. While we are watching those games, the White Sox and the Guardians, plenty of action around Major League Baseball. The races are getting really tight. You got Yankees and Red Sox this weekend. You got Dodgers and Giants. The Giants are suddenly playing a lot better baseball. The Cincinnati Reds and the Athletics, with the New York Mets like falling back to earth and allowing other teams in the National League to be alive in the wild card. But the Athletics have been like the White Sox. They've been outstanding offensively. And then the poor New York Mets trying to hold on. They have to face the red hot Texas Rangers, who are alive and well after they swept the Milwaukee Brewers at home. So I get it. It's football season. But there's some great baseball this weekend, and hopefully the White Sox continue their great play as well in Cleveland. Of course, we'll be recapping that series in our next podcast episode on Sunday nights, but that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening.
If you just discovered the Sox Machine podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen to the podcast and watch our other videos at our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine, including Instagram, as we're doing more graphics and videos. So if you're on the gram, follow us on Instagram. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. We're also on Blue Sky at SoxMachine.com. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5. That gets you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website. Unlocks the comment section as well for you. We do have a couple spots open in our Veterans Committee. We'll be meeting with our VCs next week to talk about 2026 plans, as our VC members not only have the group chat and direct access to Jim and James, which is very helpful, especially when James is working games, but we do pull back the curtain and let them know on how we operate at Sox Machine and get their feedback on how we can be better as a site, podcast, and even upcoming events next season. If that's of interest to you, you can inquire at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.